Blog Talk Radio.
This is ATL Designer, the host of In the Mood, and you are listening to Unmasked with authoress Terry E. Lyle, right here on Blog Talk Radio. You know, Terry brings you all the hot topics for your listening pleasure. Each and every Friday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. That's www.blogtalkradio.com. And you can also reach Terry direct. Her number is 347-945-6003. That's 347-945-6003. So log in, listen, enjoy. I'll see you there.
Anyone who would like to talk to my guest, just dial 347-945-6003. 6003 and hit the 1 key, and that would let me know you got a comment or a question, and I will open your mic. If not, you can just stay in the background and just listen. But our guest tonight, oh, my Lord, this woman, she is phenomenal with a capital P. Her name is Professor, get it right, people, Professor Jennifer Giles, man, and she also moved to Senior Vice President of Communications and Public Relations last Social Justice Strategy, award-winning author. Oh, my goodness, what does she don't do? She do it all. You know, now, Miss Giles, man, she has done so many things. She is an award-winning integrated communications leader, writer, content editor, producer, college professor. Experience includes Dell, SecureWorks, Jazz at Lincoln Center, AT&T, UPS, AFC Enterprises, Popeye Chicken, Cinnabon, Seattle's Best Coffee Brands, Hallmark Cars, Walmart Stores, Incorporated, ACLU, Georgia, Atlanta Public Schools, and 100 Black Men of America. She has worked with BET, Women in Film, Television, Atlanta, served as a script consultant for the upcoming motion picture Order of Rights, and is a member of the Georgia Entertainment Public Relations Alliance. She is also a professor at Georgia State University, where she teaches a range of courses in communication, is a facilitator for the Georgia Center for Nonprofit. She is a host and co-producer of the podcast Breaking Barriers with host Jennifer D. Giles on the Up to Me Radio Network. Now, I just said a whole lot, so I don't think there's room to say anything else. So I want to say hi to my co-host, Chris. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing good, Terry. Ready to interview Professor Jennifer Giles and having a great Friday night. How about you?
Same here, same here. You know, she got so much going on for her. I'm just so proud of her. And my first question for you, Jennifer, is with the confusion at the Capitol on January the 6th, what's your take on that? Because, see, when I post something on Facebook, you know, it's quasi kept. You know, I hate to offend, you know, my friends that are Caucasian. But, you know, I feel like, you know, they get mad when I express my anger and you know, from what I saw, you know. But I can let them post anything, and I don't say nothing because we're entitled to have a difference of opinion. And it's not about you being Republican or me being Democrat. You know, some things are just unattractive. It should never been done. You know, wrong is wrong, you know, and I'm just saying, you know, so I got a lot flat when I posted a picture of Donald Trump wearing a clown face, and I said, you like the clown, you get a circus. But for you who know about this stuff, protests and strategies, what's your take on this?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Terry, and thank you, Chris, for having me, first of all. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome.
You know, welcome. Thank you. So, you know, we, when I say we, Rich Philanthropic Consulting, you know, all of us looked at this scene unfold on January 6th in absolute disbelief. We like most people, had heard rumblings that, you know, that there may be a protest on that specific date, but we had no idea, and I think few people did, that you would actually see what we did, an insurrection, an attack on the Capitol and an attack on democracy. And, you know, we wrote an editorial that was released last week called The Real Patriots. Mm-hmm. And what we wrote about was the fact that you had all of these white males overrun the Capitol and very violently hurting people. And then what struck us was that the next day we saw all these black people, primarily black men, inside of the Capitol cleaning up urine, cleaning feces off the walls, cleaning the offices, and we juxtaposed these white males who came in and overrun the Capitol with these black people who had to come behind them and clean it up. And so we call those black people the real patriots, because so often as black people, we are charged with, faced with having to serve in a role that we did not ask for, a role that we did not create, but yet we rise up and we do. We were also struck by the violence that we saw, the fact that they beat a police officer to death. We were also struck by the fact that they were running in, yelling to kill the vice president and to kill Speaker Pelosi. And I think, you know, for me, the fact that the country has gotten to this point is very disturbing, very disheartening, and I might add, it's really scary to see what's out there that you don't see when you're in your home or when you're at work or when you're at the grocery store, and to know this level of
hatred.
I would say, for lack of a better term, for violence and absolute hatred. You know, it's part of our country.
But you know something, Jennifer? Somebody said to me, they said, what's so sad is that, you know, when those so-called patriots, those white supremacists came about, you know, they said that when they go to the store, before, people that owned the stores that were actually racist, they didn't really say much. But because all the stuff was building up with Trump and they killing black people, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and so many more, they said that now the people, they don't have no limit. They are getting more nastier and nastier when they talk to us. And that's a sad set of events. But this guy said, you know, I just noticed that before they wouldn't say anything, but the more this racism bubbled over in the media, you know, all along with Trump, is that more they are feeling like, I can speak up and treat you nasty because it's accepted. You know, people who's killing people, killing black people, they wouldn't get convicted of it, you know, so they was coming out their bag of tricks like, what? And being nasty, and that's just a sad state of events.
Yes, absolutely. It really demonstrates the climate that we're in and how quickly we got here. It's not that these kinds of feelings and perspectives and viewpoints did not exist before this administration, but this administration certainly, I think, created circumstances where it just bubbled up to the surface. And and now we are where we are. And if we could reverse it, which I hope we can, I believe we can, it's going to take a long time and a lot of work.
Right. Well, Jennifer, Chris has a question for you. Go ahead, Chris.
Yes, Jennifer. Well, I guess my follow-up question to Terry's is, do you think, you know, now we have a new administration. Now we got the Biden administration. Do you think 4 years of this administration, do you think it will be better because we have a woman, the first black?
You're cutting out, Chris. I think you meant to say first black female in the White House.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I said. First black vice president.
I think I heard your question. We certainly hope that it will. When we place people in high positions of visibility, like a role of a vice president, it often sends a signal to the rest of us that these are people who are accomplished. These are people who have our interest at heart. These are people who have the capability and the ability to lead change, and that's exactly what we need. But I will say also, you know, we had a black president for 8 years, and he left the White House, and within you know a couple of years after he left the White House, a new administration took over, a new president, and in you know in pretty short order, we went from zero to you know zero to 60. In terms of how the climate of the country changed. So I do have faith that it will reverse itself once again, that the climate and the culture of the country, more the climate than the culture, will shift back. But as I said, it's going to take a not just the leadership, but everyone serving as allies and as accomplices in this change that we are aiming to make, in a change that we absolutely must make. If we think about what has happened over the past few years, how intense the police violence has gotten in terms of encounters with people of color, the distrust between communities of color and law enforcement has intensified. Here in my home state, in Georgia, Ahmaud Arbery was, you know, jogging in his own neighborhood and was gunned down by a father and son who stood over him and called him the N-word as he lay dying. So these incidents are not isolated, unfortunately. They're not isolated. These are incidents that are happening in our country, in our neighborhoods, in our communities. Daily, people being killed in their own homes by police officers. Just last week, a gentleman who was having a mental health crisis was killed on his front lawn while his hands were up. Not a threat. And if you think about the social worker in Chicago, whose home was invaded by 12 white police officers while she was naked, and they would not allow her to even put clothing to dress herself, to give herself the dignity of being clothed. So these kinds of incidents are happening, I think, with more frequency. You know, there's an argument that, oh, maybe we're just hearing about them more. But I do think that the numbers of these incidents are happening much more frequently. And I think there is more of it. And, you know, we're just in a place that I have not seen this country in since pre-civil rights.
Well, my question, Jennifer, is that with all this stuff going on, and it's just not isolated, it's just too many things happening. Could you tell me, in your opinion, why people act like it's wrong for the black people or the brown people and some of the white people to be upset? You know, there are some people that, like, we shouldn't be mad. You know, why could we not be mad? I mean, because I have grandkids. I got a granddaughter. I got a child. You know, myself, cousins, sister, brothers, you know. No one's exempt, you know, because even the age, like that social worker, then right behind her was a senior citizen, a man in his 70s, it busted his house, wrong house. He was butt-naked,
yes,
and they didn't let him get dressed. And people act like that, you know, because I kind of felt a little weird at church because I'm only one of three black people total in my church. As much as I love these people at church, and I do love them because they are loving, I kind of felt a little coolness in the air because I voiced my opinion about my disdain with Trump. And they act like they don't see the news just like I see the news. And it's not about Republican with me. It's about how dare you tell these people as a white supremacist, stand down and stand back. You're condoning that garbage, you know. And people can see that he's condoning that. He has lied and lied and lied. Never once did he come out for Breonna Taylor or George Floyd to talk to the families when he got murdered. You know, he did none of that, you know. So why is it, this part of America that act like I have no right to feel some kind of way about it and to be angry?
Well, I think that that is not new. I think for some period of time, and when I say some period of time, I'm talking about, you know, hundreds of years,
mm-hmm.
That we have endured these indignities, that we have endured violence, that we have been the target of racist acts, we have been the target of people who did not and do not see us as at parity. So, you know, for me, this outrage and anger and indignation when we voice our opinions and our perspectives about our protest about not being treated fairly, not being treated right, being treated less than who we are. There's this anger that's bubbling just below the surface. Where that anger comes from, and it's not everyone, but those who do express it, where that anger is coming from, is it coming from a place of guilt? Is it coming from a place of denial? Is it coming from a place of not wanting to a partner in an anti-racist effort? You know, we believe, and I'm talking about, you know, people that I interact with, my friends, my colleagues, we believe that staying silent is nearly as bad as participating in that act. If you stand by and you see something and you don't say something and you don't intervene, you are a silent accomplice to that act.
Exactly.
Now,
like,
some may argue that that's not true. That's absolutely not true. I'm not a racist. But anti-racism is an action. Anti-racism is energy. It is not simply saying that I'm not a racist. Anti-racism is energy. It is action. It is a conscientious effort to stop something that you see as wrong, to advance the interest of everyone and not just people who look like you.
Exactly. Wow. And Chris,
Yes, my next question for Jennifer is, you know, Jennifer, I came across an article that you're part of, and I don't remember the publication, but you listed it was about women of color, and it was about all the groundbreakers, and you mentioned people like I don't know if you mentioned that, I shouldn't say you, but the article mentioned Nina Simone and Billie Holiday. So my question is, out of all the women of color in history that have made a difference and all that stuff, who would be your favorite? I mean, what are all your favorites? Like I said, out of like Nina Simone and Billie Holiday and Oprah Winfrey and, you know, all the women of color who've made a difference, who is your favorite?
Well, we wrote, my colleague, Dr. Deshaun Macon and Dwayne Ashley and I wrote a piece about 12 women that we sought to shine a light on. That article is called WAP, Women in Protest, where we focused on Megan Thee Stallion, Cardi B, Rihanna, Oprah, and these 12 women. But there's so many more that we could have placed here that don't always have a stage like a Rihanna, who is using her voice. She's one of the women that we profiled, but they don't always have that the platform that these women that we highlighted in the piece have. But if I were to go back in history and say who is my favorite, it would have to be Harriet Tubman. And the movie Harriet that was released a couple of years ago.
Yes.
I'm sorry?
The
movie that was released a couple of years ago would just kind of cemented that for me. But for her, you know, it was a form of protest. It was a form of philanthropy because we talk a lot about, we highlighted these women because they are using their voices, their platforms and influence to protest the social injustice that we are seeing each and every day on news programs, on our families, things that we're experiencing ourselves. And so we wanted to highlight how they're using their voices because the point we want to make is all 12 of these women had a choice. And that choice was we can say something and risk the backlash that might come our way, or we can use our voices and we can stay silent. To Terry's point a moment ago, when she mentioned how there was a coolness in the air when she went to church, and people felt that maybe she shouldn't have tweeted or spoke out or how, in whatever form she chose to communicate how she felt about some of these incidents. That coolness is something that we think these women risk. And if we go back to Harriet Tubman, if we go back to Billie Holiday, who sang about the strange fruit hanging from the trees were black men that had been lynched. So we wanted to highlight how we can and hope what came out of this was that you don't have to be Rihanna or Beyonce or Ava DuVernay, Viola Davis, to raise your voice and to do something to try to advance demeaning acts, try to advance the work that needs to be done to stop these demeaning acts. The voices of social justice are far and wide. Terry is a voice of social justice. And a voice against all these racial and social inequities. I've learned that about her in the conversation that we've just had. Chris, I'm sure that you are as well. So this fight that we're in against injustice and on the other side of it, trying to advance anti-racism is a difficult fight. And I use the word fight because that's exactly what we're doing and what we have been doing, what African Americans have been doing for hundreds of years is fighting for their place, fighting for their voice to be heard. And so often our voices are not heard. There's something that we look at in communication called the concept of voice. And the concept of voice is really about power. It is about who gets heard and who does not get heard. And the fact that you get heard or not is really about what power you have or don't have, or what power someone is trying to take from you or give to you. And so as we think about the Harriet Tubmans, the Nina Simones, the Madam C.J. Walker, and other women whose names that we don't know. We want to think about it in terms of us using our voice and then using that energy, which is anti-racism.
Yeah, you know, and like I said before on a previous show, I said the only thing about Black Lives Matter, I think what they could have included was the number 2. Because when we start saying Black Life Matters, then everybody coming out the world, well, Blue Life Matter, this Life Matter. And it was never about nobody being excluded. But if they had added the
absolutely.
2, that would have been we've been inclusive instead of excluded, you know. And that's what, you know, they could have added, put that number 2, Black Life Matter 2, and it would have been a different narrative on that.
Right. And it's interesting how Black Lives Matter has been politicized because it never was about politics. It was always about justice. and social change. And when we hear, you know, all lives matter, what we think as Black people, I believe most of us, if I can speak for most of us, when we hear that term, all lives matter, I think we want to put a little bit of a spin on that and say all lives should matter.
That's
all
right.
Lives should matter to everyone. And until all lives matter, then blue lives don't matter, all lives don't matter until all lives actually do matter. If you think about Oscar Grant, who Michael B. Jordan portrayed in the movie Fruitvale Station, how he was shot down by a police officer for no reason. And he, you know, died in the hospital a few hours later. But he was talking about how he was telling his police officer how he had a daughter as he lay on the floor bleeding, how he had a daughter and how he had a family. And I think when we talk about Black Lives Matter, you know, we know what we're saying, and I think most people do know what we're saying. Black lives matter just as much as anyone else's life matters. And it should be valued as such, treated as such, looked upon as such.
Yeah, you know, and I know President Trump tried to say he wanted to stop people from coming to the country as from Africa, but people from Norway, which are predominantly white, they can come in. You know, he talks like a fool because if you do the statistics of the people in the United States, you know, there are so much blended families, and I'm talking about Black children, mixed parents, you know. So it doesn't matter. You know, we as a human being together, we should just try to get through life because we're worried about us not treating each other right. Wait till the aliens come and open up, you know, because that's another story. I believe they're already here. But wait until they try to fight against us and then all the human beings, regardless of what you are, Asian, Black, Jamaican, white, whatever you are, we're going to pull together. So we ought to learn how to get along right now because we all want the same thing. We want to have a place to stay. We want comfort. We want to have a place to where you pay for our food, with our bills, or whatever. You know, we want to have a life that's not full of crime, you know, but it's a shame. It's a shame. Chris,
absolutely.
Chris.
Okay. All right. I hear you, Terry. I got it. Well, before I ask the next question, I just want to say that as a Caucasian male, I've always supported Black Lives Matter because I understand what you guys, I understand the message, and the message is you guys want to be included, and with everything that happened with George Floyd, I understand the injustice. So I've always supported Black Lives Matter. But my next question for Jennifer is, we know you, Jennifer, as, you know, as Terry said in the introduction, all the talent that you bring forth and everything that you do to teach us good things. But what did you do before you got involved with all this and showed us your smart, brilliant talent? What kind of person was you before all of this?
What kind of person was I?
Yeah, like what did you do let me be more clear. What did you do before we knew you as this, as a smart woman? Like what kind of?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well, I it's interesting. I grew up in the Midwest, in Kansas City, Missouri. Grew up in a home with, there were six children, my parents, and, my parents are from the South. And so, they imparted some of their experiences to us, as we were growing up. It's not something that they positioned as, being treated unfairly. In a way that, let me explain this. So our parents talked to us about racism. They talked to us about their experiences. But they did it in a way to impart these stories, to teach us, to help us to understand where we came from, and also to understand how we could use opportunities that we have to advance, to climb. Neither one of my parents were even high school graduates. They grew up in a time where they were, you know, basically picking cotton for their family's farms, as well as other families' farms that they were they would go and work. So early on, what was instilled was into us is that the way your life is shaped is largely around your place in the world. And our place in the world as African Americans, as Black people, they never let us forget that we came from a long line of people who had been enslaved, and that those people and the strength of those people is how we got to where we are. So I took those lessons. I went to high school. I went to college. And before I moved into working in the corporate world, which is where I started my career, actually started my career as a journalist for a Black newspaper. And then I moved over into working in private industry for a number of years. But all the while, I knew that at that time, they didn't call it social justice. There wasn't a lot of discussion about, because this is post civil rights era. So I always knew that that racism existed. I experienced it. The first time I experienced it, I was 10 years old. I never forgot it. That was 40 something years ago, over 40 years ago, actually over 50 years ago, I knew and experienced racism. But it wasn't until I moved more into working on in nonprofits in 20 years ago, I started working with nonprofits, and I worked with the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. I was a vice president there. And what the Thurgood Marshall College Fund does is provide scholarship to support to students who are attending Black colleges, students who are smart, students who are gifted, talented, goal-oriented. They have everything they need but the money in order to pursue their education. And that's when I started to become, Chris, more cognizant of the disparities that exist and the inequities that exist between the racial inequities and how those racial inequities are giving way to other kinds of inequities, educational inequities, economic inequities, health inequities. So as I worked there and started to move forward through my career at a nonprofit that helped young Black people, I think my interest in social justice and social change grew. And it never waned from that point. And so that's a little bit about me and where I came from and what kind of shapes my perspective on racial justice and racial injustice.
Well, I'm gonna play a song real quick, and when we come back, Jennifer, I want you to tell everybody how to get a hold of you. Stand by.
Yeah. It's been a long time. Oh.
Hear me.
I should have seen it from the jump. Who would have knew what we'd become? You left to love me when it's easy to take my heart away and run. You must have took off with the chauffeur. Savage, you think she flew out? I did not.
are you so hard to leave? Why are you so hard to believe? Can't you make it easy for me? Complicated in my brain. Swear to God, you made me go insane. You love me.
Actually, that's the reason why I, you know, we bought him his first car because he had a job and he was walking home at night. And I was more afraid of a police officer. I was more afraid of him having an encounter with a police officer. And it's not to say that all police officers would hurt him, but I was more afraid of him having an encounter like that than I was of, you know, a criminal, you know, robbing him or hurting him in some way. And we have to have that talk. And decades after that talk, we began having those talks. We're still having to have them. And that's the shame of it. Eric Holder,
still have
former
talk.
Attorney General Eric Holder, said that he still had to have the talk with his son, his 15-year-old son, that his father had with him some nearly 50 years earlier. 40 years earlier, excuse me. 40 years later, he's still having to have this talk. And it's not a talk that you have because you're trying to scare them. You're trying to keep them safe because
right.
It is a very real the reality is, again, not saying this would happen with all police officers, certainly not. But those police officers who do you know, we have these encounters with them, and those encounters don't produce.
Right.
We don't get up and walk away. You know, there's Tamir Rice, there is, you know, Michael Brown. There's so many that we know that these things can and do happen. And the scary part of it is, they can happen with an everyday encounter that somehow
exactly.
goes awry.
Exactly, as we can see by the news. But, Jennifer, tell everybody how to get a hold of you because we don't ran out of time. We we're going to get you back because we got so much to ask you.
Okay.
Yes.
So I can be reached at J-J-I-L-E-S. That's J. Giles, my first initial and last name. J. Giles at BPC.fund. And that's B as in bridge, P as in philanthropic, and C as in consulting, which is the name of our company, Jennifer Giles at BPC.fund.
Okay, well, I thank you so much for being on the show, and you have my cell phone, so when something else you want to discuss, just hit me up, or Edna has my phone number, and I want to thank her
That's
for
great.
As well as Larry Buford. Thank you for that. So get with me. We'll get you back on the show. Lickety split, darling, because we got so much we would like to ask you, but we just ran out of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would love to.
Wonderful.
I would love to.
Number and keep in touch, and I mean that. I'm not just saying that. I mean that. You know, tell me what you want to talk about next, and we can make it happen.
Okay, absolutely. I would welcome that opportunity. Terry and Chris, thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you
for having me and giving me this opportunity. I really appreciate your time.
We appreciate you. Thank you for spending a weekend with us. So y'all stay tuned. We got a lot of shows coming up already booked through March. So look at the roster. And Jennifer, call a sister. I got you, okay?
Okay. All right.
All right. Good evening, Chris. Chris, you take care. And you have a
you
safe
too.
Weekend. Jennifer, you have a safe weekend.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.